Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On this Politics Monday, the issues on this year's ballot. It's normal for people to research the candidates before voting. In fact, it's difficult not to, just because we're inundated with advertising for many of them. But sometimes voters are surprised to find other items on the ballot they weren't expecting and may know little about. In those cases, pulling the lever or pushing that button can be a shot in the dark on what should be items deserving consideration. For instance, this time, we are being asked to vote yes or no on an amendment to the North Carolina Constitution that would mandate only citizens be legally able to vote. But wait, isn't that already the law? I mean, why the need for this? Some say there is no need, and that is where the controversy comes in, and where people may get confused about which way to vote. In Mecklenburg County, voters are being asked to consider three bond referenda totaling about $400 million. That money is earmarked for transportation improvements, housing, and neighborhood infrastructure, but each comes with a proviso that additional property taxes may be levied to pay the principal and interest on these expenditures. So, we're going to spend the hour exploring all four items to help you decide which for you is the right way to vote. Dr. Chris Cooper is director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University and author of Anatomy of a Purple State. Julian Berger is WFAE's race and equity reporter. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Stefania Arteaga is co-director of the Carolina Migrant Network. Good morning to you all. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's radio, so you all got to talk. We don't know you're here. So let's start with the amendment to the North Carolina Constitution. It reads as follows: Constitutional amendment to provide that only a citizen of the United States who is 18 years of age and otherwise possessing the qualifications for voting shall be entitled to vote at any election in this state. Chris, the United States Constitution already limits voting to U.S. citizens who are of age. Why do we need this?
Yeah, and the United States Constitution does. And then I think more importantly, in this case, actually, the North Carolina Constitution does. And that's really what this constitutional amendment would do, would be to change the North Carolina Constitution. They'll say on the front end, this is kind of a nationalized movement. So we're seeing eight states across the country that have very, very, very similar language that they're voting on this cycle during this election. And all eight of them really move state constitutions that say every citizen can to only citizens can. I mean, really, we're debating the movement from the word every to the word only.
And I'm going to wager that all of the states that you're referencing are controlled by Republican legislatures.
That is true. Wisconsin actually has it on their ballot this time as well. And we've had some in previous years. Seven have come up in the last few years, including kind of one surprise, perhaps, in Colorado, where it passed with 63% of the vote.
So amendments to the Constitution in North Carolina don't just appear on the ballot. They have to make their way through a process. Somebody has to initiate it and put it there. What is that process, Chris? Yeah,
that process is our General Assembly. So if you would like to get something as a citizen on the ballot, you really have no way to do so except to go through a member of the General Assembly. So it goes through the General Assembly, but unlike the vast majority of bills, it does not go to the governor's desk for veto. So if you're scratching your head and thinking, well, I don't remember Governor Cooper vetoing this, it's because he didn't, it's because he couldn't, it's because that is not in our Constitution to let him have that choice.
How would you describe the process? Is it difficult? Is it easy to get an amendment to the Constitution on the ballot?
If you're a supermajority, it's pretty easy. If you are not in the supermajority, it can be, fairly easy if you still have the majority of the votes. But yeah, it's not a horrible process if you are the Republicans right now. Now, if you are the Democrats in North Carolina and you want to get one on the state constitution, I mean, it'd be like trying to complete a Hail Mary in a hurricane.
Julian Berger is with us. He's WFAE's race and equity reporter. This move started in May, if I'm correct about this, correct me if I'm wrong, in the North Carolina House. And then when they were done with it, they passed it on to the Senate. Both chambers obviously were controlled by Republicans, and the alleged threat of non-citizen voting has become a GOP talking point across the country. Is this part of that? Is that what's behind this one?
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest reasons why this is being pushed through and put on the ballot. We've seen this constitutional amendment this year. A few years ago, we saw a voter ID on the ballot, and now that's legal here in North Carolina, where you do need a voter ID to vote. And I think, you know, these are just some of the ways that Republicans are trying to make sure that non-citizens can't vote.
Chris, what does the Constitution in North Carolina say right now about our ability to vote? What does it say?
Yeah, it says that every citizen who possesses essentially the normal qualifications of citizenship can vote. So again, this is sort of a debate over whether you think it's worth having a constitutional amendment to change it from every citizen can do this to only citizens can do this. The threat that the right will say that they are seeing is from places like Washington, D.C. So Washington, D.C. Recently passed something that allowed non-U.S. citizens who are residents, who are legal, of course, to vote in local elections. And so the folks who want to pass this are saying, hey, maybe that kind of thing could happen in North Carolina. There's also been a movement in some states in local elections to have 16-year-olds have the right to vote or be able to vote. And so if you read some of the rhetoric, they're saying, hey, we want to make sure that doesn't happen here. Now, somebody else could stare at a state constitution a long time, scratch their head and say, well, doesn't it already say that?
It's semantic. And sometimes we change laws because we have to clear up the language to make it more mm-hmm. understandable. Other times we obfuscate the meaning by clearing up the language. I'm glad you brought up the fact that other states and other areas of the country are moving to let non-citizens vote, because that's one of the reasons that Senator Brad Overcash, who is a Republican from Gaston County, sponsored this bill in the Senate. Here's what he told Spectrum News.
We were seeing this swath of municipalities in, like I said, in seven different states, allowing non-citizens to vote in our election. That struck us as fundamentally wrong, as very much contrary to our ways of our constitutional republic.
So you mentioned Washington, D.C., Chris, where they're moving to allow non-citizens to vote. It's also happening in California, in Maryland, and in Vermont, to allow non-citizens to vote in local elections. Why? What's the reasoning behind that?
Well, I mean, I think some folks think that that non-citizens can be here, they can be paying taxes, they're using our roads, they are, you know, essentially doing all the other things that citizens do, so perhaps they should be able to have that right to vote. And I think it may look a little confusing, but the key part of this is local elections. You can't do this for federal elections, right? And so these states are saying, hey, we should be allowed to do this for local elections to give a voice.
But wait, I mean, if you go into the ballot box today, say we were doing this in North Carolina, allowing non-citizens to vote in local elections, there are a lot of local politicians on the ballot right now in this election. There are these local issues that we're going to talk about later in the program on the ballot. How would you let them go into the voting booth and not push the button for Kamala Harris or Donald Trump or one of the other presidential candidates?
Well, I mean, you can program a different ballot essentially for different types of citizens. It's okay. Also possible if it's in an off-year election, right? And states run elections in radically different ways. So I don't know the details of all seven of these states and territory, including D.C., but it could very well be the case that local elections are in off-year elections, whereas federal elections are in even-year elections. And so it would be, in that case, a pretty simple process. Yeah. And again, I'm not sure exactly the details of the Vermont ballot.
Stephania, you can be a non-citizen and be here legally. You can be a non-citizen and have crossed the border illegally and be working. And because you're working, you're paying taxes you're paying Social Security taxes because your wages are being, those monies are being deducted. You may never get the benefit of it, but you are paying that money in. Is there a feeling within the migrant community that non-citizens should be able to vote because they are paying taxes?
Thank you, Mike. Well, I think to begin with, what we're mostly hearing is concern from naturalized citizens who are hearing the removal of the word naturalized citizens being trying to be removed from our state constitution. These are individuals who have gone through the legal process, who have applied for U.S. citizens, who have taken a civics test and passed, and have sworn an oath to our constitution and to our country. And so one of the concerning things we're hearing in our community and through conversations we've had with Spanish-speaking partners is that naturalized citizens are concerned about their right to come out to the polls this election. What's happening with this constitutional amendment is that it's creating a non-issue. It's an attempt by far-right extremists who are trying to single out immigrants and naturalized voters at that as well, who know very clear that our elections are protected and that U.S. citizens are the ones that can vote.
We're talking about some of the issues on this ballot that don't involve candidates, but involve things like bonds, and in this case, the constitutional amendment in North Carolina, on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Mary, are there any municipalities within North Carolina that you are aware of that are attempting to let or would like to let non-citizens vote in local elections?
None that I am aware of. As you mentioned, there are some places like Washington, D.C. that have sort of tested this, but I haven't heard of it coming up anywhere in North Carolina, no.
So, Stephanie, the U.S. Constitution says, quote, every person born in the United States and every person who has been naturalized shall be entitled to vote at any election. Senator Overcash, who I referenced from Gaston County in the North Carolina Senate, and others have worded the North Carolina constitutional amendment to specify only a citizen of the United States shall be entitled to vote at any election. And you've kind of alluded to this already. That's a subtle difference, one which Overcash says brings clarity. Does it, and does it make a difference?
I wholeheartedly disagree. I think if anything, it creates a false narrative around the integrity of our electoral process. And it also creates confusion within our naturalized citizen population. And just to put it into perspective, two-fifths of foreign-born individuals in North Carolina are naturalized and do have the right to vote this election. And so there is a percentage of our population who are seeing this language and are confused.
So for those citizens who came here through channels, who jumped through all of the proper hoops, who took the oath to the United States Constitution and became naturalized citizens, are they concerned that this is targeting them as well as those people who didn't do any of those things, who may be here without papers, etc.?
I would say absolutely. You know, this is this constitutional amendment, essentially what it's trying to do is perpetuate fear in our electoral system. It is trying to perpetuate a falsehood that there are folks who are voting who are not allowed to do so. It is creating a narrative that we have heard for close to 8 years now about stolen elections. And these things are absolutely not true. Yeah. We have robust voter registration processes in North Carolina where folks have to put in the last four digits of their social or their North Carolina driver's license number or identification, and that is checked by the North Carolina Board of Election. There are various processes in place that make sure that we have a robust, clear process to ensure that there is fair and clear elections.
And Julian, I see you're nodding vigorously during this. Have you heard this from people you've interviewed? And I have 20 seconds. Have you heard this from people you've talked to?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen very few cases of non-citizens casting ballots. So the idea that non-citizens are voting in our elections is just not true.
Okay, we've got to take a break. We'll come back with more and talk about this constitutional amendment to the North Carolina Constitution allowing only citizens to vote. Seems redundant, but we'll do it. And then we'll come back and talk about the bonds on the ballot as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the non-candidates on the ballot. For those of you who have yet to vote, who are going to be voting between now and November the 5th, these would be the constitutional amendment to the state constitution allowing only citizens to vote, and the three bond issues that are on the Mecklenburg County ballot, having to do with lots of things like roads and sidewalks and housing and more, which we'll get to later in the program. So Chris Cooper's with us. He is the director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University and author of Anatomy of a Purple State. Julian Berger is our race and equity reporter for WFAE News. Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Stephanie Arteaga is co-director of the Carolina Migrant Network. Chris, once again, the U.S. Constitution says every person born in the United States and every person who has been naturalized shall be entitled to vote. This amendment to the North Carolina Constitution says only a citizen of the United States who is 18 years of age and otherwise possessing the qualifications of voting shall be entitled to vote. This seems like a very subtle difference. Is that purposeful? Does this open the door to court challenges in the future if we say yes to this amendment?
I mean, heck, the recent history of North Carolina politics would say everything we do opens us up to court challenges. So I don't see much exception here, right? I mean, it is an extremely subtle change. And I know I've said this a couple times, but it's so important, right? Most of the state constitution, even this section, would remain the same. It is essentially changing every to only. And if folks are trying to figure out where this came from, I'd encourage you to Google ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council. And so what they do is they come up with, and there's folks like this on the left too, but they come up with model legislation that they say, hey, we think states should pass this. And so if you look up the ALEC model legislation, it's going to look pretty similar to what you're seeing in North Carolina, in Kentucky, in Iowa, in Wisconsin, in Idaho, Missouri, Oklahoma, and South Carolina, which are all states that are considering very, very similar ballot language in 2024.
Let's not minimize the impact of ALEC or the Heritage Foundation on the right of our politics, because they have been playing the long game for years, and they have become incredibly influential in policy and in what right-wing politicians have to say and what they want to achieve. According to a poll conducted by Carolina Journal, 76% of voters in North Carolina support this amendment. That includes 56% of Democrats and 96% of Republicans. And Julian reports that the State Board of Elections says there were only 6 complaints of non-citizens casting ballots in the 2020 election and the 2021 municipal elections. Is this a constitutional amendment in search of a problem, Chris?
I mean, I don't know. I think that's for voters to decide. I mean, clearly there's not a rampant voter fraud. We do not have lots and lots of people who are trying to take advantage of the system. I think study after study, whether conducted by academics or by boards of elections themselves, show that this is not a problem that we've had in the United States. Obviously, voters get to decide how to vote on this question, but I mean, I think we'd be disingenuous if we said this is a rampant problem in our state or in any other state. With that said, We've seen it pass. Every time this similar legislation has been brought up, it has been passed 7 times over the past few years. And generally speaking, when constitutional amendments come up in the state of North Carolina, they tend to pass, right? And so I think the one piece we haven't talked about is the ability perhaps of an amendment like this to generate turnout for the Republican Party. And I think a lot of people think that's one reason why this amendment made it on the ballot. And for example, getting rid of the literacy test did not make it on the ballot.
Stephanie.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to add Democracy North Carolina, which is a nonpartisan civic engagement organization that does a lot of voter protection during the election season, actually came out with a one pager talking about the concerns around this constitutional amendment. And one of the ones that stood out to me was that it, and I quote, opens a path for confusion on voting eligibility, not only for naturalized citizens, but also for 16 and 17 year olds who have the right to pre-register to vote. So yes, there are concerns that it may seem like a minimal change, but there are future concerns around what this constitutional amendment can mean for ensuring that people have access to the right to vote. Apart from, the allegations of voter fraud, that the narrative that we're seeing perpetrated by certain elected officials, it also creates mistrust in our elections, and it's perpetuating anti-immigrant hate and racism, very much like what I mentioned around naturalized citizens not feeling like comfortable or sure if they even have the right to vote, even though per the federal constitution and our state constitution, they surely do.
So we have an email question from one of our listeners. They said, this feels like it came out of nowhere. I wasn't aware of this amendment till I went to vote. Was there an attempt from Democrats or others to not have this on the ballot, or did it catch everyone off guard? Julian?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have been hearing about this amendment kind of late. It's kind of late in the game that we've kind of heard from Democrats and from Republicans alike kind of this controversy. And like that poll referred to from the Carolina Journal, there's an overwhelming majority of people that do support it. And I think you read it, you read the referendum on the ballot, and you kind of are like, oh, this does make sense. Like, only citizens should be able to vote in the election. But it's not until you hear from kind of advocates what this amendment can do and what are the implications of it. So,
And you spoke with Wendy Mateo Pascual, coordinator of the Latino Civic Engagement Committee, who feels that this amendment is unnecessary.
I'm concerned with this, that people that are naturalized, they think that they cannot vote and they don't go, but also that in the future, other change can happen and say that only people who born on United States are citizens.
And Mario Alfaro, the public policy manager at El Pueblo, it's a nonprofit that advocates for Latinos, says this amendment is dangerous because it opens the door for confusion. He says it may make people believe they have lost their fundamental right to vote. Is that the majority opinion, Julian, in the Latino community?
Yeah, one definitely. I think Wendy made an interesting point. She said that once this amendment, if it is passed, it can lead to more actions from Republicans in order to ban naturalized citizens from voting. And that's what she thinks. She thinks that in the future, naturalized citizens will be taken away their right to vote in state and local elections.
Well, this may or may not be pointed at the Latino community. It's obviously pointed at this hysteria that's being driven by our porous southern border. And there's no question that we've had an enormous number of people come over the border. But what message does this send? I'm not sure which one of you to ask this of, to the immigrant community at large. Take Latinos out of the equation. What does it say to the Asian community? What does it say to other people coming here from other countries? Does it say you may be on a slippery slope from being disenfranchised?
Regardless of, whether you come into this country as a naturalized citizen or you come, as an undocumented person, people know that when they are not citizens, they can't vote. So I think there is some rhetoric behind this amendment that's being passed. I also did some reporting last week of these yellow campaign signs that were being put out at the polls, telling non-citizens that they
Yeah.
can't vote, and that if they do vote, they'll be deported. The signs were in Spanish, so it just goes to show that rhetoric from that non-citizens can't vote.
I want to get to that in a second. That's kind of off the topic, but because we're talking about amendments, but I do want to talk about that. You mentioned, Chris, that this could be an effort for to increase voter turnout for Republicans because this is a Republican issue around the country. It's certainly one for the presidential candidate, Donald Trump, who hammered on this yesterday at Madison Square Garden. Could it also be a means simply to sow confusion and to suppress voter turnout?
I think that's possible. I think it is much more likely that it is what it appears, which is something that they think will pass, something they think will be very popular, something they think will drive some of their voters to the polls, and also the kind of issue that they think might put some Democrats in an uncomfortable position. And the reason I say uncomfortable is because every time these kinds of proposals have been on a ballot so far across the country, they pass, right? So North Carolina state legislators who put it on the ballot know that, and they know that Democrats in the General Assembly are likely to be opposed to it. So it's a way to put your opposition in some ways in opposition to something that is likely to pass. I mean, in terms of the politics, I think it's fairly clean, even if the execution, I think, as the other panelists have pointed out, is not so clean.
Mary Ramsey, you wanted to jump in here too. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just think the point that you and Chris have already made about voter turnout can't be overlooked in this conversation either. Republicans have made a concerted effort in recent years to politicize election integrity. It is an issue that motivates their base right now. And in an election that's going to be incredibly close, where turnout is going to be critical, this could make a difference. It's not a brand new, unheard of strategy. It's one that Democrats have embraced in recent election cycles around abortion. Since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, they have made a concerted effort to get abortion-related amendments and referendums on ballots across the country to help motivate their base. So it's not an unheard of strategy, but it's absolutely, I think, part of the strategy behind this amendment here in North Carolina.
So Chris, bottom line it for me. What will change about voting and who is eligible to vote in North Carolina should this constitutional amendment pass, and what will happen if it fails?
I can summarize this pretty quickly. Nothing and nothing, right? I mean, essentially, this would not, at least in the short run, change anything about who is eligible to vote, who gets to vote. If it doesn't pass, it's going to be roughly the same. I mean, there's just even the folks who are the staunchest advocates for this, they're not saying that in the short run, this is going to change something about American elections. They are trying to argue that, well, not trying, they are arguing that this will close a loophole before something squeezes through it.
So although the LA Times and the Washington Post are not endorsing for president this year, the Charlotte Observer, I don't know that you have endorsed for president, but you have, Mary, put out endorsements at other offices. And yesterday, the editorial was to vote no on this constitutional amendment because it's vaguely worded. It's an amendment in search of a problem, they said. And they do not believe, your editorial board does not believe, in that it will keep our elections safe or secure. Who makes these decisions at The Observer?
The editorial board, and we actually share an editorial board with our sister paper in Raleigh, the News and Observer, includes our deputy opinion editor for The Observer, Paige Mastin, includes our executive editor here in Charlotte, Raina Cash, as well as similar folks over in the Raleigh newsroom. So completely separate from the news division, which includes reporters like myself, but includes a lot of our excellent local journalists who just take the opinion approach.
So the amendment comes at a time when these yellow signs, Julian, that you referenced a moment ago, have been appearing at voting locations telling non-citizens they cannot vote and warning that doing so would be a federal offense. These are factually accurate signs, but there is some controversy about these. Why?
Yeah, I think, like you said, they are factually accurate. They, you know, if you do vote, you can face an offense, you can possibly be deported, you know, this is true, but they're in Spanish, they're in a lot of these signs, they're yellow, they have big wording on it. A lot of people do feel that they are caused to make non-citizens fearful of going out to vote.
And they were placed by an organization called the North Carolina Election Integrity Team. That's part of a national organization run by Cleta Mitchell, who is an attorney that helped Donald Trump attempt to overthrow the 2020 election. She was, in fact, on the call to the state of Georgia asking them to find votes for Donald Trump, and she's been working toward doing something similar in this election should he lose. Jim Womack is with that organization.
North Carolina is woefully inadequate in its processing of non-citizens. They still haven't started removing non-citizens from the voter rolls, which leaves us no recourse other than to monitor the voter lists and to advise citizens through these signs.
That, in fact, the state removed 750,000 citizens from the rolls last month, found only nine non-citizens among those they removed from those rolls. Is he correct then that we haven't started to remove non-citizens from the rolls, Julian?
No, I think, like you just mentioned, there were only nine non-citizens that were on the the list of the 750,000 people that the Board of Elections removed. So very low numbers. Also, like I mentioned before, there were only six non-citizens who had voted in the 2020 general election and the 2021 municipal election.
We're talking about the constitutional amendment and some of the other things surrounding voting that you will find on the ballot this time around. And when we come back in a moment, we'll also be talking about the bond issues on the ballot. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Stephanie, Mr. Womack says that our state is woefully inadequate in its processing of non-citizens. What do you suppose he means by that?
Well, Mike, I think that continuously we keep on hearing these attempts by politicians, by folks who have a clear political agenda of what rhetoric they want to put out to their constituencies around just like the integrity of our election system. The reality is, and as you mentioned, you know, folks who are paying for these yellow signs outside of polling places, the folks that are behind the reason we have copycat bills like HB 1074 that brought us the constitutional amendment. This is all part of a strategy to confuse voters about what is already within our North Carolina and federal constitution, and then also create fear. You know, as our organization has taken a very clear stance that we are in trying to encourage voters to vote against this constitutional amendment, not just us, but other voter integrity organizations to ensure that voters know that this is a non-issue. What is an issue is getting aid to the Appalachia, right? What is an issue is ensuring that we have proper funding for our school systems. And making a non-issue around this rhetoric that there are lost votes or people who are voting who don't have the right to do so, that is absolutely just incorrect.
Julian spoke with a man named Hector Vaca with an organization that fights for racial, gender, and economic justice called Action NC about these yellow signs.
It's definitely a targeted effort toward the non-English speaking community, toward the immigrant community. So it's very targeted.
And at one point, he was encouraging people who see those signs at polling places to report them to election officials. Mary, you reported last week that the State Board of Elections ordered some of those signs removed from polling places. Apparently, some of the signs had slightly different wording on them. I have 40 seconds. Talk about that.
Yes. So there are these yellow signs paid for by the North Carolina Election Integrity Team that will be allowed to stay up. They use a Spanish word that roughly translates to citizen. There's another group that made a similar but slightly different sign that uses a different Spanish word that roughly translates to foreigner. The State Board of Elections is asking election officials to take that sign down because they're concerned it could be interpreted by some naturalized citizens who have every right to vote as confusing them and making them think that they don't have the right to vote that they do.
Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter for The Observer. We're going to put her to work in a second when we come back from the break and talk about the bond issues on the ballot. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org, listener-funded, by the way. I'm Mike Collins, here with Dr. Chris Cooper, professor and director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University, author of Anatomy of a Purple State. Julian Berger is our race and equity reporter here at WFAE. Stephanie Arteaga is co-director of the Carolina Migrant Network. And Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We're talking about issues that are on the ballot that you will face when you go to vote that are not related to candidates. We've talked a lot about the constitutional amendment allowing only citizens to vote, but now we're going to turn our attention to things that are only on the Mecklenburg County ballot. Those are the bond issues. Mary, there are three of them on the ballot. They are all for improvements within the city of Charlotte and will involve property tax increases. We're going to talk about that. Within the city of Charlotte, are these bonds only on ballots in precincts that are within the city of Charlotte, or do Huntersville and Cornelius and Matthews have these initiatives on their ballot as well?
My understanding is that these are only City of Charlotte bonds, and so they are only on City of Charlotte ballots. Obviously, during early voting, any resident can go to any polling place in their county, but when you are check in to vote to get your ballot, they will figure out exactly what municipality you live in, so you'll only get a ballot related to where you live.
Okay, so voters are being asked to approve money for transportation, housing, and neighborhood improvements. And I want to point out that each of these bond referenda begin with this sentence, quote, additional property taxes may be levied on property located in the city of Charlotte in an amount sufficient to pay the principal of and interest on bonds if approved. In the past, we were always told that these bonds would not increase property taxes. Clearly, these may. Is this something new and different? And if so, why? What's changed?
This is a bigger than normal bond ask for the city. This is a larger amount. The three bonds total up to about $400 million than the city is used to asking. They have already come out and said that on 2025 and 2026 ballots, the bond issues are likely to be a bit smaller than normal to sort of even things out. But as we learned in the budget process this past summer, property taxes did go up in the city of Charlotte. City Manager Marcus Jones was very blunt about the fact that they needed to, that they likely would need to again. In to simply pay for the needs of a rapidly growing city.
So in the first of these bonds, it deals with transportation and asks voters to say yes or no to authorizing $238.3 million plus interest for the capital costs of street improvements. And if I read the wording correctly, there is no mention of trains or buses or streetcars or any vehicles whatsoever. It's all about street and state highway improvements and their associated costs, along with sidewalks and pedestrian and bicycle paths. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. This is completely unrelated to the Red Line, completely unrelated to the Silver Line, completely unrelated to the sales tax increase. That is a separate issue that won't be on your ballot until 2025 at the absolute earliest. What this $238 million would pay for is about $50 million for sidewalks, $55 million for new road projects, $20 million for Vision Zero, which is the city's effort to reduce traffic fatalities, and the additional money would go to projects like street resurfacing, intersection improvement, and congestion mitigation.
Was it done this way because the legislature came back and told us that our transportation plan was too focused on trains and not enough on roads, and so they've eliminated that from this, or was this always the plan?
This was always the plan. Okay. These bonds were discussed. What exactly they would pay for was discussed and approved by the city council during their budget process. And that process was completely separate from the sales tax referendum draft legislation, the Red Line, the Silver Line, things like that. Two different issues.
This bond referendum for transportation reads, the estimated amount of property tax liability increase for each $100,000 of property tax value to service the cumulative cost over the life of the bond will be $1 per year. And it reads that the debt will last for 20 years. So it's $1 per year for 20 years on each $100,000 value of your property. So it's $4. If you have a $400,000 piece of property, it's $4 a year for 20 years. Again, are they telling us positively, if we vote yes, that these taxes will in fact be levied?
That's what's likely to happen. Obviously, the economy can change rapidly. The city's fiscal situation can change rapidly. So there might be less of a need for a sales tax increase 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the line. There might be more of a need for an even bigger increase 2 or 3 or 4 years down the line. We can't predict the future, but the fact that the city is willing to come out and say, yeah, there's about a pretty 99% chance we're going to have to up your property taxes to pay for this is probably a pretty good sign about how they
and
feel.
It reads as an estimate. So that means that this could be higher as we go through the coming years, or it could be lower, doubtful, but could be lower. Do most people see these figures as reasonable, or do you know?
I think people are definitely concerned about their property tax values. We had an increase at both the city and county level in the last year. I don't think anybody was happy about that. Some on the council raised concerns about putting that onto home buyers at a time when they are dealing with higher prices for everyday goods. That being said, as those who have supported this and City Manager Marcus Jones have said, we are a rapidly growing city. We have a lot of infrastructure needs, and they argued that this is simply the cost of doing business.
So we have an email. I'm not that reads this way. I'm not sure if this is fair, but it feels like every election there is more and more being asked of voters when it comes to bonds that lead to an increase in taxes. Does it just feel like more is being asked of us more frequently, or is that just anecdotal?
As I mentioned, this is a bigger than normal bond ask for the city of Charlotte. They have said that the bond cycles over the next 2 years. They're going to try and do a smaller than normal ask to even things out. But yeah, this is definitely a bigger ask.
Because we do have transportation bonds on the ballot on a regular basis. We do have neighborhood improvement bonds on the ballot on a regular basis. We're going to talk about the housing bonds, which have come every 2 years now in increasing amounts. The next one is this affordable housing bond that voters have said yes to in the last several elections. Cycles. Is this one any different from the previous bond issues for housing?
So the housing issue is interesting this year. For one, it is bigger. It is doubling from 50 million to 100 million to go
but
into.
But we've done that before, haven't we?
We have increased the amount before, but this was the largest it's ever been. It's never been 100 million before.
Okay. 100 million. 100 million.
$100 million to go yes. into what's called the city's housing trust fund, which helps fund affordable housing for low and middle income homes. What the city has done and already approved heading into November is if this referendum does pass, they've approved new guidelines for how they're going to spend this money. They are going to, they say, make a more concerted effort to make sure they're really hitting their target groups. For who they want to get in this housing, they're going to be more considerate about where this housing goes, making sure that they're putting people in neighborhoods where their kids have access to good public schools, where they have access to amenities like recreation centers and grocery stores, and also pushing their partners that actually develop and run this affordable housing to provide supportive services to people living in these housing, things like job assistance.
So every 2 years, on average, the city has come to voters at election time and asked for $50 million to $100 million now for affordable housing. There's no question the need for affordable or workforce housing is great. Teachers, firefighters, police officers sometimes cannot afford to live in the city in which they work. And so the need is great. But it seems like the need always outpaces our ability to maintain and increase the supply of affordable housing, these bonds notwithstanding. So is there any way to gauge how the money voters have said yes to, and we've always said yes to these bonds, is there any way to gauge how that money is being used and the impact those monies have had?
A lot of that is centered in what I was just talking about, the idea that the city necessarily hasn't done the best job sort of accounting for those things in the past. And so they're really trying to step up heading as they increase this from 50 million to 100 million. They're really focusing on making the spending out of the housing trust fund more targeted and also making sure that they have more oversight of it, that they can look and do a better job of accounting for where the money is going and what sort of impact it's having in the community, not just getting people into a place to live in the short term, but also improving their long-term economic mobility and stability.
And this, too, has a property tax increase associated with it, even greater than the previous bond, the transportation bond. This is going to be about $1.30 per year for each $100,000 of property tax value over the next 20 years. Are we hearing anybody complain about that, worry about that, concerned about that, either on the government side or on the citizen side?
We have, yes. So all three of these bond referendums passed 10 to 1 when they came before the city council. The lone vote against was Councilmember Tariq Bakari, who said during that meeting and during the budget process that he's all for funding a lot of these projects in theory, but is concerned about the property tax burden on Charlotte residents, especially given the city was already increasing property taxes this last budget cycle. The county increased property taxes, and people are dealing with higher prices for everyday goods as well outside of housing.
And of course, the city has no tools in its toolkit to encourage developers or to force developers, that's the better word, to put affordable housing in some of the new construction that they build. So this is really the only way we can do it because we have so few tools. I want to go back to the transportation bond for just a second, because the wording indicates that some of the money will be used to repair, construct, resurface, etc., state roads, which are supposed to be funded by the state, and the state is not funding them. So the city of Charlotte citizens are being asked to do jobs to fund these roads, having already paid taxes to the state to do that. Am I wrong?
I don't want to misspeak or overspeak. I know there is a lot of discussion frequently from the city about the fact that taking care of these state roads sometimes will fall onto the city a little bit. I'm by no means an expert. I'm not trying to just throw a word salad at you that doesn't mean much of anything, but I'm just, yeah, I'm not exactly sure of the exact answer there. Not something I've done a lot of digging.
So before we run out of time, let's talk about the last referendum on the ballot. That is the bond referendum focused on neighborhood improvements. They have been on the ballots in recent years. This is for $61.7 million plus interest for capital costs of improvements, including reconstruction, improving, installing, or providing curbs, gutters, storm drainage, sidewalks, pedestrian and bicycle paths, and improving streets. And it goes on from there. But how is this bond different from the transportation bond, which is worded very similarly?
Yeah, so some of this money will be going to similar things like sidewalks, pedestrian paths, bike paths, and traffic control. Also, about $25 million of that $61 million will be going into the Corridors of Opportunity program, which is a city initiative that focuses on six targeted areas in traditionally underserved communities in Charlotte and helps promote everything from new businesses to affordable groceries in those communities.
So passage of this bond would mean an additional 20 cents per $100,000 in tax value in property over 20 years. So taken together, we're looking at an additional $2.50 per $100,000 of tax value for 20 years. Have voters said yes to all of these in the past?
Largely, yes. Yeah, bond issues tend to pass relatively easily in Charlotte and in Mecklenburg County. Last election cycle, for example, we saw an historically large school bond pass relatively easily here in Mecklenburg. So these things do tend to fly through.
We're talking about the bond issues you'll find on the ballot when you go to the polls on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Are voters likely to say yes again to these, Mary?
I would say yes. Yeah, these are the things that, you know, pop up on the end of the ballot. Most people just say, yeah, more sidewalks sounds good, and click yes.
So we're in the speed round now. Early voting turnout is reported to be high in many states around, actually all, in states all across the country, and particularly in the battleground states, including North Carolina. But Mecklenburg usually lags the state. We disappoint the state in terms of our voter turnout. What's it been like this time, Mary?
Yes. So once again, the state of North Carolina did break its single day record for early voting turnout on the first day, but Mecklenburg County trailed its 2020 level. And another sort of, if you dive a little bit deeper into the data that stood out, is there's been a significant drop in Black voter turnout during early voting compared to 2020.
And Julian, what do we know about minority turnout, Latino turnout in this election cycle so far?
Yeah, we've seen about close to 50,000 Latinos get registered to vote. So that number has been increasing over time. But in early voting, the number that I saw last week on Thursday, it was around 7,000 Latinos had voted early. So that number is still low, but we're hoping for it to increase.
So Stephanie, despite these yellow signs that we talked about, the rash of accusations about non-citizens voting and the general suspicions about election integrity being circulated by some, do Latino and other minority voters appear to be cowed? Have they experienced any harassment or discomfort when they've gone to vote? Do you know?
Well, I wouldn't be able to tell you a specific incident that may have occurred in the city apart from these yellow signs that we are seeing. But what I can say is that we are seeing a lot of excitement from Latino voters. Just this Saturday, we saw a march of Latino queer voters who marched to Panther Stadium, the first of its kind in the city of Charlotte, where they casted their vote. And so we are seeing a lot of excitement that we haven't seen in the past.
And Chris, since you're joining us from Western North Carolina, Hurricane Helene did major damage. And I know the State Board of Elections has made some provisions to make sure people have access to polling places. Early voting has been underway. Are you confident that those who want to vote, those who would normally vote, those who have time to vote, given all the other things they have to deal with, are able to do so?
Yeah, I think the hard part is the second part of that question, who would normally vote? And I think we just don't know yet. So far, yes. So about 7.76% of the electorate is who has voted thus far is from the 13 most affected counties. That's roughly on par with the percentage of registered voters. So what does that mean? It means that thus far, this region is voting about where you would expect. Now, there's a whole lot of caveats on there, including the fact that oftentimes there is increased turnout compared to the rest of the state in this region, and will just remain to be seen what happens on Election Day.
Dr. Chris Cooper with Western Carolina University, Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Stephanie Artiego with the Carolina Migrant Network, and Julian Berger with WFAE. Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.